All right, amen. Let's open our Bibles tonight. We're gonna go to Revelation chapter 13, and I'm gonna try, if I can, tonight to a couple of guys that don't go to our church have been a couple of other pastors actually that we've been discussing these things that we've been teaching over these last few weeks about. The rise of militant Islam and what place that plays in prophecy. And it's the several guys that I've spoken to about it, we all had the same kind of reaction. It's not the right word, but the response to this is that it wasn't something that anybody had really considered before. And now it seems that a lot of guys are paying this a little more attention, and it's been interesting. And so one pastor who has been listening to the lessons on Wednesday nights on the website asked me to sort of summarize everything if I could. And so I sent him back an email today just as best I could, just sort of summarizing all five Wednesday nights that we've done on this, just kind of in one, it was just one page, a page and a half, just like the main points. And I thought it's been so interesting to me, and I ordered several books on the subject, and that's been provoking a lot of study and things on my part. So it's been on my mind a lot, and it's been spent a lot of time just reading every day, and hours and hours and hours a day. But there's still a lot of things just swirling around in my head, and I'm afraid that I could just go on for another 6 weeks or 10 weeks or 12 weeks on this same subject, and I just need to wrap it up here on this aspect of it, the rise of militant Islam. So what I'm going to try to do tonight is just basically take the notes that I summarized for this pastor and just sort of put it all together tonight and just summarize our thoughts on the importance of this. Of the rise of Islam and what part it plays in prophecy, and in particular, the idea that the Antichrist could be a Muslim. Right, so we're just going to sort of do that tonight. But in Revelation chapter 13, we'll just start there, a couple of verses, and then we'll give you sort of a summary of this whole subject, at least as best as I can from what I understand so far. All right, Revelation chapter 13. And I stood upon the sand of the sea and saw a beast rise up out of the sea, obviously the Antichrist, having seven heads and ten horns, and upon his horns ten crowns, matching exactly what it says in Revelation 17. Same beast, heads, horns, and so on and so forth. And the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard. That's important, because the first characteristic that John sees is this, that it's, in general, this beast coming up out of the sea, which is the Antichrist, is like a leopard. Now, we looked at that last Wednesday night, and I'll touch on it again in a minute. But that's an important statement. It was like a leopard. Its feet were the feet as of a bear, and its mouth is the mouth of a lion. And the dragon, which is Satan, that dragon is mentioned in chapter 12, verse 3, the great red dragon, which is Satan himself. And the dragon gave him his power. So this beast, which is both a man and a kingdom, in the book of Daniel, Daniel sees these beasts coming up out of the sea. He sees a lion first, then he sees a bear, then he sees a leopard, and then he sees a fourth beast, which he doesn't even know what it is, and he just calls it a terrible beast, the fourth one. But each one of these, Daniel goes on to explain that each one of these beasts represent two things: a kingdom, and then the king of those kingdoms, like the head of those kingdoms. And so the same is true in the book of Revelation. All right. So this beast that comes, this represents the kingdom of the Antichrist, which is probably right now being put together. You know, it's the groundwork for that kingdom has already been laid. And the king of that kingdom, the Antichrist himself, is very, very likely alive somewhere. And so this beast coming up out of the sea has in general the characteristics of the leopard. All right, and we'll touch on that again tonight just to summarize it. But he's got the feet of a bear, the mouth of a lion. The bear, if you remember, represented from Daniel chapter 7, the bear represented the kingdom of Persia, and the lion represented the kingdom of Babylon. And those were world kingdoms that had a connection to the nation of Israel. As we said before, there have been other great kingdoms other than the ones mentioned in the Bible, and yet God only mentions them because of their connection to his people, Israel, because to the Lord, that's all that matters. And that's the focus of the Bible. The nation of Israel is at the center of most of the things written in the Scriptures, even in the New Testament, the first church in Jerusalem and so on, and Paul's gospel that went first to the Jews, and then and so on and so forth, and the book of Revelation centering back on the nation of Israel again. So you can't take away from the fact that this book is primarily about the Lord Jesus Christ, first. Secondly, about the nation of Israel. I mean, there's more in here about the nation of Israel than there is about the body of Christ. Now, the parts about the body of Christ are obviously essential to us. But the book as a whole has more to do. God's eyes are upon his nation. And what God and all the prophecies in the Old Testament pointing toward the nation of Israel, because Jesus Christ is going to reign from there for 1,000 years. So anyway, all right, so let's go on. Verse 3, and I saw, verse 2. And the dragon gave him his power and his seat and great authority. So it looks like Satan gives to the Antichrist for a temporary period of time. It turns out in verse number 5 you find out that it's 3.5 years. He gives him Satan's own power. So this creature and this kingdom has an incredible amount of supernatural power. And gives him his seat. So Satan has a seat. Revelation 2:13 says that it speaks about Satan's seat, which was in the city of Pergamos in the days that John wrote the book of Revelation. But since Revelation is a prophecy, then that means in the tribulation, Satan's seat will also be there. And so there's Pergamos is in the western part of what is today Turkey. The city is still there, Pergamum. It's interesting also in Pergamum was a gigantic altar that was built to the god Zeus, or Jupiter. And I don't know when this happened, I didn't really look it up, but the Germans dismantled that altar. This is a gigantic altar, and I don't know if you probably Google and look at pictures of it, but this is massive, and they moved it to the Museum of Berlin. This altar would be the size of bigger than the size of this building. It would be two of these buildings. It had gigantic steps going up to it, a colonnade, like a big, I don't know what they call it, but a gigantic porch with columns that went all around it. And the Germans dismantled this whole thing and transported it back to Germany, and it sits in the Museum of Berlin now. The government of Turkey for many years sued to get it back from Germany, and Germany has never given it back. And so the Turkish government, in recent days, rebuilt that thing. Rebuilt a replica of this temple to Jupiter. Because Jupiter in the Bible, I mean not in the Bible, but in mythology, is supposedly the father of all the gods. He's the big god, Zeus. And I don't know if you remember, but in the book of Acts, in the city of Ephesus, remember when Paul and Silas went to Ephesus and they preached the gospel and it caused an uproar? Ephesus is in Turkey, not far from Pergamos, and the whole city was like in an uproar, and they just kept crying out for 2 hours, it says, "Great is Diana, great is Diana, great is Diana, great is Diana." It sounds like, almost like, you know, the statement that Muslims cry, and they could probably do that for 2 hours without stopping. And in English, it is, you know, great, Allah is greatest, or Allah is great, something like that. But that's interesting that, and the temple of in Ephesus, which was a temple to Diana, it says it was the temple of Diana and the image that fell from Jupiter. So there was an image, a stone of some sort. And when I looked it up, it said it was most likely a meteorite that fell to earth. And the Ephesians believed that it had fallen down from Jupiter, from the god Jupiter, and they held it as sacred, and it was in Ephesus. It's very interesting that in Mecca is a stone, a meteorite that supposedly fell from heaven. And in the Quran, Muhammad says that in when the Mahdi, you know, it's their version of the Lord when he comes back, that that stone will speak. And that stone in Mecca is in the corner of this of the Kaaba, which is the holiest site in Islam. And Muslims are supposed to go there once in their lifetime, make a pilgrimage to Mecca. They circle that Kaaba, that building, seven times, and supposedly their sins are forgiven. But in the end, in the days of the end, Muhammad said that that stone would speak. It's very interesting, right? And in Ephesus, it was called the image that fell from Jupiter. So like there's these connections to Turkey, and in the book of but Satan gives to the Antichrist his seat, and for some, and his seat was in that day, and looks like it will be again in Western Turkey in Pergamos. All right, but anyway, it says, and they and I saw one of his heads as it were wounded to death, and his deadly wound was healed, and all the world wondered after the beast, and they worshipped the dragon which gave power unto the beast. And they worshiped the beast, saying, who is like unto the beast? Who is able to make war with him? And there was given unto him a mouth speaking great things and blasphemy, and power was given unto him to continue 42 months. And he opened his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle and them that dwell in heaven. All right, so anyway, so there's a description of the Antichrist. I'm going to give you just a few things, kind of in summary. A few of these things, though, we haven't talked about yet. But as I was just trying to think about how to summarize this for this other pastor, this is what I had given him. All right, first of all, here's the first thing. And we're not going to go into any depth on a lot of these because we've already mentioned them. But in summary, Psalm 83, if you remember back when we studied Psalm 83, seems to describe a future war of nations against Israel. It describes a war that nowhere in the scriptures or in history that we can tell has ever taken place. And it's an alliance, a confederacy of 10 nations that surround Israel, seem to go to war with her, and they're all overcome. It's hard to say when that war takes place, but it's yet to happen. But they're all Islamic nations. Those 10 groups of people in Psalm 83 are all today Islamic nations. In Ezekiel chapter 38, we looked at that either last week or the week before. Ezekiel 38 and 39 are very important. In Ezekiel 38 and 39, it speaks of Gog, G-O-G, Gog. And Gog was a person, is a person. He turns out to be synonymous, the Gog in Ezekiel 38 and 39. Let's go back there real quick. We're not going to restudy it, but just so you can see, if you weren't here that night, you can just see what we're talking about. Ezekiel 38 mentions in verse number 2, son of man, set thy face against Gog. And there's all kinds of controversy as to who these people are, what these nations are, because notice the names that are mentioned here. Gog, the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshech, Tubal, down in verse number 3, Meshech again, and Tubal, down in verse 5, Persia, Ethiopia, Libya, verse 6, Gomer, Togarma, and these are all involved in what in chapter 38 and 39 are described as a great battle that takes place in Israel. And it's the description of this battle in Ezekiel 38 and 39 is the same as the description elsewhere in the Bible of the Battle of Armageddon. So Ezekiel 38 and 39 are describing the Battle of Armageddon. Gog is the chief prince. In other words, he's a picture, he's a type of the Antichrist. In the Bible, the Antichrist has several names. In the book of 2 Thessalonians, he's called the man of sin, the son of perdition, that wicked. But he has another name here, and that is Gog. So Gog, the man of sin, the son of perdition, that wicked, is Satan indwelling and working in a human being, a man, like the one in Revelation chapter 13. That's a man. And the dragon gives that man his own spirit and power and authority. And as he will with Gog, because this is prophecy, and the man of sin in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, son of perdition, so on and so forth. It's also in Ezekiel. You might remember, if you go back about 10 chapters, go back to Ezekiel chapter 28. Ezekiel 28, look at verse number 11. Ezekiel 28, this is not the only time in the book of Ezekiel where God seems to be addressing a human, but the human is really Satan working in that human. Ezekiel 28, look in verse number 11, it says, "Moreover, the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Son of man, take up a lamentation upon the king of Tyrus." The king of Tyrus. And notice what God says to him. "Thou sealest up the sum, full of wisdom, beauty, perfect in beauty. Thou hast been in Eden, the garden of God." So obviously that was not the human that was king at that time of Tyre. Tyre is a city in present-day Lebanon. So here the Spirit of God is addressing not the man, but Satan in that man. It's like when Jesus Christ spoke to Peter, and Peter had just said something to withstand the Lord, and Jesus Christ said, "Get thee behind me, Satan." He's looking at Peter, he's talking to Peter, but he's addressing the spirit of Satan himself that was at that moment using Peter to undermine the will of God. And the Lord does that in the Scriptures. He addresses here the king of Tyrus, and it goes on down to say in verse number 14, "Thou art the anointed cherub that covereth." That's Satan. Verse 15, "Thou wast perfect in thy ways from the day that thou was created." Obviously, that can't be the human king of Tyrus. He wasn't perfect. And it says, verse 16, halfway down the verse, "Therefore I will cast thee out as profane out of the mountain of God. I will destroy thee, over covering cherub." So it's obvious that the Lord is addressing Satan himself. He did it again in Isaiah chapter 14. He speaks to the king of Babylon, but the king of Babylon in Isaiah 14 is Lucifer. It goes, as you read down through that passage, you find out that the Lord is actually, that the king of Babylon there is not the literal human king of Babylon, and the king of Tyrus is not the human literal king of Tyrus, but Satan. And so the same is true in Ezekiel 38. When God is speaking about Gog, he's not speaking about a human, and there might have been a human king, and there might, but God is speaking to that, to Satan, who's using that individual. And remember, even Judas himself, who's the only other one in the Bible that's called the son of perdition, remember in John chapter 13 and verse number 27, it says that Satan entered into him. So the son of perdition, right there in the presence of Jesus Christ, had Satan in him, working in him. And the Antichrist is called the son of perdition. So these are all names for the same kind of a person and the same sort of a thing that's going to happen in the last days. Imagine that, a man who has Satan himself and all of his power and all of his strength working in him to set up this world kingdom. It's going to be a terrifying thing. And speaking of Gog and Magog, if you go all the way back to the end of the Bible, Revelation chapter 20, you'll see that at the end of the millennium, just before the heavens and the earth are dissolved, and just before the great white throne judgment, in Revelation chapter 20 and verse number 7, it says, "And when the 1,000 years are expired," that's the millennial reign of Jesus Christ, when the Lord is on the earth, and there will be peace on the earth. The Lord will rule with a rod of iron. There's not going to be any open rebellion against the Lord. There won't be any open unrighteousness. It's going to be heaven on earth for 1,000 years. Even though the earth is going to be populated by unsaved people, they're going to be kept in check, in a sense, by a righteous government. The Lord is ruling with a rod of iron. I mean, that seems like a pretty severe way to govern, but that's the way the Lord is going to do it. But inwardly, there'll still be plenty of people, even in the millennium, whose hearts secretly are wicked against the Lord. But during that 1,000 years, Satan is bound up in the bottomless pit. At the end of that 1,000 years, Satan is briefly loosed out of that pit, as it says here. "When the 1,000 years are expired, Satan shall be loosed out of his prison." And notice the immediate thing that happens once he's loose. "And shall go out to deceive the nations which are in the four quarters of the earth." And there they are again, Gog and Magog. So it'll either be another individual that Satan will literally fill with himself, he'll inhabit, he'll possess a man's body, another Antichrist right at the end, but his career is very short. He doesn't even get 3.5 years. I don't think he gets 3.5 hours, because he gathers up the nations. Magog just represents the nations that follow Satan, as it did in Ezekiel 38. That's all Magog is, are the nations that follow Satan into the battle of Armageddon. It says in Gog and Magog to gather them together to battle, and the number of whom is as the sand of the sea, and they went up on the breadth of the earth and compassed the camp of the saints about and the beloved city, and fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them. So there's no battle, there's no war, just God is done now. He just sends the fire down, destroys them, and Satan is thrown into the lake of fire. And then immediately comes the great white throne judgment at the end of the world. All right, so it's important to know what Ezekiel 38 and 39 represent. That's the Battle of Armageddon. Gog is the Antichrist. Magog and all those other lands, Togarma, Meshech, are all today Muslim lands. Gomer, Togarma, Meshech, most Bible maps with atlases of the Bible lands and of those ancient countries all place those nations in present-day Turkey, Syria, Armenia, northern Iran, all in that area around Israel. So those nations in Ezekiel 38 and 39 also happen to be today Muslim nations. And there they are involved in the Battle of Armageddon. All right, another one. all of the nations named in the Old Testament that Jesus Christ fights when he comes back are today Islamic nations. That's an important point. Going back to the book of Revelation, the seven heads in Revelation chapter 17, chapter 13 and chapter 17. If you remember, just comparing chapter 13 to chapter 17, look at verse 1, chapter 13, 1. Here's a beast rising up out of the sea with seven heads and 10 horns, and upon his 10 horns, 10 crowns. Go over to Revelation 17. You have the same beast, and it says in verse number 3, Revelation 17:3, carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-colored beast full of names of blasphemy, having 7 heads and 10 horns. All right, so there it is again. Later on, John asks the question, what does all this mean? What is this beast with the 7 heads? And the Lord explains it to him. It says, verse 8, the beast that thou sawest was and is not. All right, was and is not. We'll come back to that in just a second. It says, verse 9, here is the mind which hath wisdom. The 7 heads are 7 mountains, not 7 hills, as is often taught. You know, people try to make this out to be the city of Rome and the Roman Catholic Church. And one of the things that they use to make the connection is Rome is built on 7 hills. Well, there are other cities, including Mecca, by the way, and Istanbul, which are built on 7 hills as well. But it doesn't say hills. It says mountains. And the Bible is specific. When it uses the term mountain in the scripture, it always refers to a kingdom. And we did that last Wednesday night, so we're not going to go back over that. But the 7 heads are 7 mountains, or 7 kingdoms, on which the woman sitteth. And there are 7 kings. 5 are fallen. So 5 of these kingdoms in the days of John the Apostle, which would have been the 1st century AD, 5 are already fallen. What would they have been? Well, the first nation, the first empire that had anything to do with the nation of Israel would have been Egypt, where God's people were imprisoned for all those centuries, right? For 300 and more years. And God brought them out of Egypt. So the first one has to be Egypt. The second one was the kingdom of Assyria. We were just reading about that at home in the last couple of days, where Assyria came in and took the 10 northern tribes prisoners. And as far as the scriptures are concerned, there's no record of them ever coming back. Right? As later happened with Babylon, Babylon came in later and took the Jews, the tribe of Judah, into captivity in Babylon, where they stayed for 70 years. But God promised them that when that 70 years was up, they were going to come back, and he was going to deliver them. No such promise was made to the 10 northern tribes, which made up the bulk of the Jews in those days. I mean, I don't have any idea if these numbers are accurate, but I've seen numbers estimating what the population of those 10 northern tribes would have been, and it would have been in the millions, not the hundreds of thousands. So you're talking about millions of people that the Assyrian nation came in, took captive, and it even tells you the cities in which they resettled those Jewish people into what is today Iran, Armenia, the lands which, if you look on a map, all those lands, those countries around the Caspian Sea, which all end in Stan, Afghanistan, Turkmenistan, I forget what they're, there's like six or seven of them up there. All those lands up in that area was the nation of Assyria. And the Jews were taken up into that area, and as far as the Bible is concerned, as far as we know in the scriptures, they never came back again. And instead, the Assyrians took people from those lands and settled them into northern Israel. That's why the Jews had such a problem with the Samaritans, because the Samaritans were the descendants of those people who were basically Assyrians and Iraqis and Iranians that had been brought into northern Israel and resettled into that land and probably intermarried with any of the Jewish people that had been left behind. I'm sure they didn't gather up every single living Jew and take them into Assyria. There may have been some, even the Babylonians, when they came in and conquered Judah and took the Jews captivity, they left the poorest people behind. They took what they would consider the cream of the crop. That's what they wanted. They wanted laborers. They wanted workers. They wanted servants. That was the reason for taking them back into your country as prisoners. So just like Babylon would have left the poorest people behind, the Assyrians may have done the same. So, but for the most part, the people that ended up living in that land of northern Israel would have been a mixture of Jewish blood and Gentile blood. And that's why the Jews in the time of Jesus Christ despised them. They were Samaritans. They didn't even consider them to have any dealings with the Jews. All right. But anyway, so the first kingdom was Egypt. The second kingdom was Assyria. We're in Revelation 17. It says, verse 10, five are fallen. That would have been Egypt, the kingdom of Assyria, the kingdom of Babylon, the kingdom of Persia, and then the kingdom of Greece. In the days of John, those were the five that had fallen before the days of John. John was living, and it says, and the sixth, verse 10, and one is. So the one that was in existence in John's day would have been the Roman Empire. The five before it were gone. The Roman Empire was existing at the time of John, that John was alive. But it says, and the other is not yet come. So what kingdom came after the Roman Empire? There would have been one more, and the one that came after it was not the Antichrist kingdom. Because the Antichrist kingdom, as you read down in verse 11, is the eighth, not the seventh. So, seven heads on this beast: Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, Persia, Greece, and the sixth being Rome. Which one is the seventh? And that's always been the controversy. But the seventh world empire in history, the only empire that actually governed the same landmass. If you looked on a map to see what area of the world did Assyria cover, you color that in on your map, okay? Then you look at what area of the world did the Egyptian Empire cover, color that in. And what area of the world did the Babylonian Empire cover, color that in. And then what area of the world did the Greek Empire cover, color that in, all the way from Macedonia all the way down into Egypt. Well, the Roman Empire covered only a small portion of that. The Roman Empire never controlled Iraq, never controlled Iran, barely controlled Egypt. But if you look at a map of the Roman Empire, it only had a small sliver of Palestine. It did not govern Arabia or any of those places. But there was an empire that if you colored in this empire, it covered everything that Greece, Egypt, Assyria, Rome, Persia once governed. There was only one, and it was the Ottoman Empire. It was an Islamic empire that reached all the way from the Balkans. That would be present-day Serbia, Romania, Czechoslovakia, Bulgaria. The Ottoman Empire controlled that part of Europe, Eastern Europe, all the way to India, all the way up into the stands, and all the way down into Egypt, Libya, and all the way along the northern coast of Africa. So the Ottoman Empire, in its expanse, covered all of those previous empires. Right? It didn't go as far into Europe as the Roman Empire did, but the Roman Empire never covered as much ground. The Roman Empire did not cover the ground that the other empires did. Only one, the Ottoman Empire. And it ruled for 471 years over all that landmass. So it was very powerful in its day. It was very cruel in its day. It was bloody in its day, probably the bloodiest of any of those kingdoms. There was more civility in the Persian Empire and the Roman Empire, as we said in one of the lessons recently. The Roman Empire was basically merciful to the nations that it captured. It preferred not to slaughter the inhabitants, but to basically make them Roman citizens. They could even keep their own religions. The Jews, under Roman rule, still had their temple. They still had their priests. So Rome, when it came in, didn't slaughter all of the unbelievers. Didn't, you know, many times the rulers could stay in place. Herod was still king under the Romans. So, but when the Ottomans came in, it was a completely different story. Unbelievers were slaughtered. You know, Islam was instituted. So it had a much more aggressive and bloody attitude toward the lands that it conquered, even against other Muslims. It obviously, in order to gain all of those Muslim lands, had to overcome other Muslims. Even today, there's more bloodshed as Muslims fight against Muslims than there are Muslims against, you know, the rest of the world. But the Ottoman Empire was the one that overthrew the Roman Empire. So I've never seen anywhere in any books in the past that I read on prophecy any place that the Ottoman Empire ever played in anything related to the Bible. And yet, it's the only empire that makes any sense. It's the only one that could be the fulfillment of this in Revelation chapter 17 and verse number 10. The other is not yet come, and when it does come, it would continue for a short space. It didn't last as long as the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire started before the days of Jesus Christ and lasted till 1453. So, I mean, there's more than 1,500 years of the Roman Empire, and the Ottoman Empire, by comparison, was less than 500 years. So it continued for a short space relative to the other ones. But there it was. And then it was, in a sense, it was wounded, because the Ottoman Empire collapsed during World War I, and was finally eliminated in 1924, when, as a result of having sided with Germany in World War I, the Islamic Ottoman Caliphate was dismantled by the victors. Because of all the treaties after World War I, they dismantled the Ottoman Empire and gave all and divided all the lands up to the various nations. Britain got a piece of the Middle East. France got a piece of the Middle East. That's why Lebanon is mainly French and Syria. France got Lebanon and Syria. Britain got Canaan, got Egypt, and so on and so forth. And so the victors in World War I just took the Middle East and divided it up. They made new boundaries. They made boundaries for Iraq. They established Saudi Arabia. There was no such country as Saudi Arabia before World War I. It was various Arab nations, small Arab nations. But the Saud family was the most powerful, and Saudi Arabia, named for the Saud family, was created out of all these Arab peoples in that part of the world. So the Ottoman Caliphate was wounded. The Bible says in Revelation chapter 13 that this beast that comes out of the sea has a head that received a deadly wound but is revived. So that eighth head, the Ottoman Caliphate, was wounded. It was dismantled. The Ottoman Caliphate didn't die of old age. I mean, its enemies wounded it, but it's not completely dead. You know, it continued to exist and has existed since 1924, and there have been attempts ever since then to revive it, and it's happening right now in a newspaper every day. It looks like to me that's the revival, or the resurrection, if you will, of that eighth head. Notice, or that seventh head. Look in verse number 11. And the beast that was, now that goes back to verse number 8. Verse 11 says, and the beast that was, the beast that was, well, it has to be referring to something before John's day. The beast that was. Because in verse 8 it says, the beast that thou sawest was and is not. Meaning it existed before you, John. It's not around right now, but it's coming again. So that can't be Rome. It has to be one of the previous five, which would have to be the beast. And the kingdom of the Antichrist has to be closely connected to one of the first five. It has to be related in some way to something that was, but no longer existed in the days of John, but would almost like rise again out of, would come up out of the bottomless pit and then go again into perdition. So that means the kingdom of the Antichrist has to have something to do with one of the first five. And in Revelation chapter 13, the Lord tells us which one of the five. He tells us that it's primarily got the characteristics of the leopard. All right, and we looked at that. All right, so that seventh that comes up after Rome is the Ottoman Caliphate, which conquered the Roman Empire in 1453. It took Constantinople, renamed it Istanbul, and began to rule the Middle East. And the Ottoman Caliphate represents the Islamic religion at its greatest extent worldwide, stretching from the Balkans to all of northern Africa. That head or that beast was wounded in 1924 and is being revived even as we speak. All right. Now that eighth head, as we said, or the kingdom of the Antichrist, is closely connected to one of the ones that came before John. And Revelation 13 tells us that it is primarily the characteristics of the leopard. And if we went back, we did this last Wednesday, I think, but if you would do, just look back real quickly to Daniel chapter 7, just to refresh your memory on what the leopard is. Daniel chapter 7. I think I've read the book of Daniel more in the last few months than I have in my whole life. And it's been a blessing. The things that, like, just, I'll be honest with you, just confused me in the past seem to be fitting together a little bit better. But in Daniel chapter 7, Daniel sees this vision of these beasts coming up out of the sea. And just as John describes in Revelation 13, these two chapters are very similar. It says, and remember verse 4, Daniel 7, 4, the first was like a lion, that's Babylon. Verse 5, the bear is mentioned in verse 5, that would be the kingdom of Persia. A lot of similarities there that we don't have time to go into. But verse number 6 is the third, which was the third of the beasts that Daniel saw, but the fifth of the heads that John saw. So don't get confused with here it's the third and in Revelation it's the fifth, because in Revelation God also goes all the way back to Egypt and Assyria. Those are not mentioned in Daniel because Daniel was only looking to the future. And at the time Daniel lived, the kingdom of Egypt and the kingdom of Assyria were already behind him. It didn't matter. God didn't even address them in the book of Daniel. So from Daniel's point of view, it was only everything from his point of view and forward. So in Daniel's day, he lived in Babylon. So with Daniel, it starts with Babylon, then Persia, then Greece, and then Rome. Those are the only four that Daniel speaks about here. But in the book of Revelation, God is just taking the big picture in. So he goes all the way back. So in Daniel, it's the third kingdom. But in the book of Revelation, it's the fifth kingdom. And they're both the same. Five in the Bible. Anybody remember what five represents in the scriptures? Five bleeding wounds he bore. Five in the Bible is always related to death in the scriptures. So the fifth kingdom in the book of Revelation is Greece. In the book of Daniel, it's the third kingdom, but they're the same. It's the leopard here is the third, and it's the leopard in Revelation, which is the fifth of those. But let's look at the leopard here. It says, after this I beheld, and lo, another, like a leopard, which had upon the back four wings. And remember that the kingdom of Greece under Alexander broke into four parts. There's the four wings. And the beast had also four heads. So the kingdom of Greece became into four parts, and dominion was given to it. All right? But notice that this Greek kingdom is represented as a leopard, and the primary thing that John is shown about the Antichrist is that he's like a leopard. So there's a connection, there's a close connection to something in the book of Daniel. Now it turns out that from Daniel chapter 8, for the rest of the book of Daniel, guess which one of those four kingdoms Daniel focuses on? Not Babylon, not Persia, not even the fourth one, but Daniel focuses on just one, the third. Daniel chapter 8, chapter 9, chapter 10, chapter 11, chapter 12 focus on Greece. Or not the country of Greece, but the Greek kingdom, which was much expanded much farther than Greece. It was actually from Macedonia all the way around to Egypt, that entire part of the Middle East. It included Iran, it included Iraq, it included Egypt, it included Israel, Saudi Arabia. Turkey and all the stands up around the Caspian Sea and so on and so forth. So why does the Lord spend so much time in the book of Daniel after he's shown us these kingdoms and these beasts, and then God zeroes in on one of them? Well, if Greece had no future significance in the last days, why spend the next five chapters showing us more detail about the leopard? And then Revelation 13, this Antichrist has the characteristics of this leopard. All right, so it becomes important. Go with me to the book of Hosea. The book of Hosea. The very next book, right after the book of Daniel. So, Hosea, look at Hosea chapter 13 and verse number 5. God says, I did know thee in the wilderness, in the land of great drought. According to their pasture, so were they filled. They were filled, and their heart was exalted. Therefore have they forgotten me. God's talking about his people. In specific, God is talking about, if you look up in verse 1, he's talking about Ephraim. Now, Ephraim was one of the 12 tribes, but in the New Testament, just as Judah sometimes, the name Judah is sometimes just used to represent the nation as a whole, the southern part of the nation that followed David, Ephraim is sometimes used to summarize all of the 10 tribes in the north. In the book of the prophets, when God says Ephraim, he doesn't mean just the tribe of Ephraim, but he means the entire northern kingdom of Israel as contrasted against Judah. So here God is talking about the northern part, the northern tribes, Ephraim. And God says, verse 5, I did know thee in the wilderness, in the land of great drought, brought you out of Egypt, brought you through the desert. I knew you then. You knew me then. You knew the kind of God I am. You knew how I could take care of you. And according to their pasture, so were they filled. They were filled and their heart was exalted. Therefore have they forgotten me. Therefore I will be unto them as a lion, Babylon. As a leopard, by the way, will I observe them, Greece. I will meet them as a bear, Persia, that is bereaved of her whelps, and will rend the call of their heart, and there will I devour them like a lion, the wild beast. There's the fourth one, is just called a wild beast, shall tear them. All four kingdoms are there. So in other words, God was going to use Babylon, Persia, Greece, and even Rome, the wild beast, in a sense as a form of judgment, as punishment to the nation of Israel because they had forgotten the Lord. So the leopard is mentioned there. Go to the Song of Solomon. The Song of Solomon. These are unusual places to find prophetic things, but I just saw this today. I just went through my Bible and looked up leopards. And this was kind of amazing here in the Song of Solomon. Song of Solomon, chapter 4. And you might remember that the Song of Solomon is understood on several levels. Number one, it was Solomon's letter, love letter to his wife, a real woman that he married and loved. But it's also God's love letter to his nation Israel. It's also Jesus Christ's love letter to his church, the bride of Christ. And it's also got a lot of practical stuff in it for any husband who really loves his wife and so on and so forth. So there's at least four levels that you can take the Song of Solomon on. And it's true on every one of those levels. But notice, on one of those levels, with God and his nation Israel, notice in chapter 4, verse number 8, God says, "Come with me from Lebanon, my spouse. With me from Lebanon. Look from the top of Amana." You can look on a map and find out that that's a mountain near Damascus. It's a mountain range near Damascus. And that's a mountain in that range, the tallest of those mountains near Damascus. "From the top of Shinar, which was another name, it was actually the Aramaic name for Mount Hermon. So it uses both names here, Shinar and Hermon. Mount Hermon is in the very northern part of Israel. Part of the mountain is in Israel. The rest of it is in Syria. It says, "From the lions' dens, from the mountains of the leopards." So the lions and the leopards are connected with Syria, right? The lion was Babylon. That's that same part of the world. The leopard was Greece, but not the Greece that you're thinking of in Europe, but what became of the Greek Empire after it fell apart. The part of that Greek Empire that fell apart, the only part that God focuses in on is one part of the four parts, and that was the part centered in Syria. The king of the north is described in Daniel chapter 10 and Daniel chapter 11. He was the king of that northern part of the Greek Empire. By the way, that part of when Alexander died and his kingdom, his vast kingdom, all the way from Macedonia in Europe to India, up into the stands, and down into Egypt. Alexander had conquered all of that in just a matter of a few short years and died all before the age of 33, died at the age of 33, because as far as he knew, there weren't any other empires to conquer, and he died drunk and sick in Babylon. And after his death, his kingdom is divided up into four parts, just like Daniel had prophesied. This happened hundreds of years after Daniel. And it happened just exactly the way God said it would be. And Alexander the Great's empire broke into four parts. His four generals, four of his chief generals, warred with each other and fought. And eventually they each took a chunk. A guy named Ptolemy took Egypt. And a guy named Seleucus took what is today Syria, Turkey, Iraq, that whole area, Armenia. That was Seleucus. And then Ptolemy in the south and Seleucus in the north. North and south, because Israel is always the center of God's world. So as far as Israel is concerned, Ptolemy's in the south, Seleucus is in the north. Daniel chapter 11 calls them exactly that. The king of the south, the king of the north. And they fought with each other, with Israel in the middle, so many times. But Seleucus built a capital for himself. And the name of his capital, Antioch, which later became where your Bible came from. Paul's, the greatest New Testament church in the Bible, was in that same city. But in the days before Jesus Christ, in the days of that Greek Empire, Seleucus built a city, built Antioch, named it after himself, and Antioch Epiphanes was one of his descendants, and he was the one. Antioch Epiphanes is described in Daniel chapter 11 and in Daniel chapter 8. God gives you a little glimpse at the kind of a guy that he was in history. But notice that in the Song of Solomon, that area of Syria around Damascus was, God connects it with lions and leopards. He leaves the bears out. Well, the bear was Persia. Persia was on the other side of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. But Iraq, Babylon, and Syria, or the king of the north's land, all around that area near Damascus. So when the Spirit of God takes Israel up and says, "Come here. Come up with me into the mountain. Come up with me into Amana, this mountain, and Mount Hermon, the tallest mountain in that area. This is the land of the lions and the leopards." Now, were there actual lions and leopards there? Probably. But the Spirit of God is always giving you clues, prophetic clues throughout the Scriptures. So that area is the land of lions and leopards. And so that connects it to the leopard in prophecy, the leopard in the book of Daniel and the leopard in the book of Revelation. Those are the so in other words, the bottom line here concerning that is The kingdom of the Antichrist is going to have a connection, a direct connection to that part of the world, to where the Greek Empire, the Seleucid Greek Empire, where Seleucid and his descendants reigned for several hundred years in that area. So the Antichrist has got to come out of that area. If you go back to Daniel with me, we'll take a little, just have a 10 minutes or so here, and we're going to take a look at Seleucid, or Antiochus Epiphanes, as he was known in history. Daniel chapter 8. Daniel chapter 8, the Lord zeroes in on the leopard, the third beast that Daniel saw, which was the kingdom of the Greek kingdom. But in Daniel chapter 8, God describes it not as a leopard this time, but as a goat, a very strong he-goat that breaks this ram in pieces. The ram in this chapter represents Persia. And it says, verse 8, therefore the he-goat waxed very great, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken. And later in the same chapter, God interprets his own prophecy and tells you that that horn was the first king of Greece, which was Alexander. And it says, the great horn was broken, and for it, or in its place, came up, verse 8, four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven. So there's the four parts of Alexander's empire. And notice verse 9, and out of one of them, four parts to Alexander's empire, Ptolemy took Egypt, Seleucus took Syria and all the lands around that, Lysimachus was one. He took western Turkey, and I forget who the guy was that took Macedonia and Greece. But those guys aren't even mentioned again in the scriptures. The only ones that have any interest to the Lord are the two that are neighbors to Israel. So God never, Alexander's empire breaks into four, but God neglects the other two to tell you anything about them. It doesn't matter to the Lord, because Ptolemy and Seleucus are the only ones in their history they have anything to do with the nation of Israel. So God is going to show you those two kings, and he does. The rest of the book of Daniel focuses in on those two. And in verse 9 it says, and out of one of them came forth a little horn. Now that little horn is also mentioned in chapter 7. That little horn is the Antichrist. That little horn is, it says, waxed exceeding great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the pleasant land. And it waxed great, even to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host of the stars to the ground and stamped upon them. Yea, he magnified himself to even to the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifice, which would be the sacrifice in Jerusalem and the temple, was taken away. So out of one of those four parts of Alexander's empire comes a little horn. And that little horn existed in history long ago. 175 BC was a man named Antiochus Epiphanes, who was the eighth descendant of Seleucus, so the eighth king. It's interesting that the Antichrist will be the eighth, and Antiochus Epiphanes was the eighth from Seleucus. And he was a real guy, probably demon-possessed. And in verses 8 through 12, it's a description. He's a preview of the Antichrist, but in these verses right here, it's actually describing not the Antichrist of the future, but his predecessor, Antiochus Epiphanes, who reigned for only a short period of time from 175 BC to 164. I don't know whatever that works out to be. When 164, that'd be 11 years, right? So he only reigned for 11 years. And it says, he takes away the daily sacrifice, so on and so forth, right? Then, now Daniel sees this, but Daniel wants to know, well, who is this? What are you talking about? So God says, verse number 15, came to pass when I, Daniel, had seen the vision, sought for the meaning. Then behold, there stood before me as the appearance of a man, and I heard a man's voice between the banks of Ulai, which called and said, Gabriel, make this man to understand the vision. So God sends the angel Gabriel to explain this vision that Daniel has just seen. It says, then we'll just jump down to verse 20. The ram, this is Gabriel explaining it to Daniel now. The ram which thou sawest having two horns are the kings. This thing keeps falling off, I'm sorry. Are the kings of Media and Persia. The rough goat is the king of Greece, Grecia. And the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king. Now, that being broken, Alexander died, whereas four stood up for it, four kingdoms shall stand up out of the nation, but not in his power. In other words, Alexander died, did not transfer anything to these guys, could not help them establish their kingdoms. They had to fight between themselves, raise their own armies. Alexander could, he died prematurely. He didn't set up anything. He didn't set up any instructions for the government that came after him. These guys had to, basically out of everything that Alexander conquered, they had to carve their own little empires. So they couldn't stand up in his power because he's gone. They had, in other words, they were kings in their own right. And it says, and in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up. Now that king in verse number 23 can be both Antiochus Epiphanes, who was a real Syrian king. He was actually a Greek, and he's the one that established the Greek culture all throughout the Middle East. When Jesus Christ came into the world, it was a Greek-speaking world. That's because of Seleucus and his descendants. They built Alexandria in Egypt. And the scriptures, the New Testament scriptures, were written in Greek because that was the language of Israel in those days, right? Because of the Greek culture that permeated the Middle East because of Seleucus and his descendants, one of whom was Antiochus. But Antiochus had a problem. He believed that he was God. In fact, his name, he attached after his name the word Epiphanes, which means God in the flesh. He was actually Antiochus the Fourth, and he called himself Antiochus Epiphanes, God in the flesh. And the coins that Antiochus made showed himself as Jupiter, as Zeus. He believed that he was the reincarnation of Jupiter, Jupiter in the flesh, God manifested in the flesh. Just like the Antichrist is going to do when he comes. He's going to believe that he's God walking around on the earth. Well, there was a preview of this guy, Seleucus, or one of his descendants. Antiochus also hated the Jewish people. He hated them. He fought back and forth with Egypt because Egypt was very wealthy, very, very powerful, a lot of wealth and treasure and gold and silver in Egypt. Seleucus got it, or Antiochus got it into his mind early in his reign. He started in 175, so this would have been 174 BC. As soon as he took power, he decided to go and overthrow Egypt. And he did. He succeeded. But the Romans at that time, they weren't yet an empire, but the Romans were gaining strength, even 200 years BC. They were still a very powerful nation. And he was afraid that the Romans were going to intervene and take Egypt away from him, so he left Ptolemy in charge in Egypt, just as a puppet, but he actually had overthrown him and overthrown Egypt. And as he was in Egypt, a rumor spread in Israel that Seleucus had been killed. And he had imposed the Greek culture and the Greek language. He had removed the high priest in Israel and put one of his puppets in place. The one that he put in place as a high priest in Israel had actually built a sports arena. I forget what they called it. I think it actually was called a gymnasium. It wouldn't be what you think of today, but a gymnasium would have been like a gigantic arena where they had sports contests, and they did it in the manner of the Greeks. All the men fought in the nude. That was the way the Greeks did it. And so this was being practiced in Israel, in Jerusalem, and the high priest that Seleucus, or that Antiochus, put in place had built one of these giant arenas near the temple. And so these Greek games were being played. So the Jews hated him, he hated the Jews. But he goes to war in Egypt, and a rumor spreads that Antiochus has been killed. Well, with Antiochus dead, guess what the Jews do? They revolt. They overthrow his high priest, the one that Antiochus put in place. Well, Antiochus hears about this while he's in Egypt, and he comes back to Israel in a rage Now, these things are all in the history books. This is all documented. It's in the book of 1 and 2 Maccabees, and it's in Josephus, and it's in many of the historians of that day. All right, so he comes back into Israel. He desecrates the temple. He puts a statue of Jupiter in the Holy of Holies. He desecrates the temple with pig's blood. And Israel is and the temple are desecrated for exactly 3 years. I was hoping it was going to be 3.5, but it was exactly 3 years. Guess what day of the year he actually did that? He desecrated the temple, set up a statue of Zeus, his god, in the temple in Jerusalem on December the 25th. 3 years later, on December the 25th, exactly to the day, the Maccabees overthrew Antiochus, not him personally, but his armies, overthrew and they recaptured the city, and Antiochus died of some disease just shortly, immediately thereafter. So the temple was desecrated with a statue of Zeus for exactly 3 years, from December 25th to December 25th, because that day was very holy to Jupiter and to Zeus. It was connected with the sun god. And so there in history is an example of what the Antichrist is going to do in the tribulation. Desecrate the Holy of Holies, make it desolate, set up an image, think of himself as God. And all of this actually happened in history in the person of Antiochus. All of that is right here in the book of Daniel. Now, when Daniel wrote this, Antiochus wasn't even born yet. None of this had happened. But God is writing it in advance. And it happened just exactly the way God said that it would happen. And notice in verse number 23, in the latter time of their kingdom, here's this king. It was both Antiochus, and probably this will apply to the Antichrist also, a king of fierce countenance, meaning what? What would a fierce countenance be? He didn't have a very pleasant face. He didn't have a face a mother would love. He's got a very stern outlook. I mean, in looking at his face, people would fear. So this guy's got, he's full of anger. Right in his eyes, you can see there's something about him. His countenance is always fierce. So there's something. Now, that was Antiochus. History says so. That'll also be true of the Antichrist. He's not going to be a pleasant fellow to deal with. He's going to be a man of fierce countenance, an angry man, a man full of rage and wrath. Fierce countenance. Understanding dark sentences. Verse 24. And his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. That's certainly going to be true of the Antichrist, who's going to give him, the devil's going to give him his power. He shall destroy wonderfully, meaning people are just going to stand there with their mouths open at the ability that this man has to wage war, shall prosper and practice and shall destroy the mighty and the holy people. Antiochus did that when he got back from Egypt, when he heard what the Jews had done to try to revolt. When he got back to Jerusalem, he killed 40,000 Jews and sold another 40,000 into slavery. He threw people off the walls of the city, chopped off fingers, beheaded people. I mean, it was bloody. He did that immediately when he got back. So he waged war against the mighty and the holy people. Antiochus did it, and the Antichrist is going to do the same. It says, and through his policy also he shall cause craft to prosper in his hand. He shall magnify himself in his heart, and by peace shall destroy many. So he's going to be an expert at making peace treaties that he doesn't even intend to keep. Muhammad did that. He was an expert at making peace treaties that just bought him time. That's the way Islam works. Make a treaty, buy yourself time to get stronger, and then when you're strong enough, then you take advantage of your enemy. So that's the Antichrist method of working. He shall also stand up against the prince of princes. Now that has to be the Antichrist. But even Antiochus did it in a sense, because he stood up against the high priest in Jerusalem. And even though Israel was not living in a, you know, they weren't in a great relationship with the Lord at the time, that position, that office of high priest was still sacred to the Lord all the time, even in the days of Jesus Christ, even in the days of the Apostle Paul. That high priest's office was sacred to God. And Antiochus had no fear that he's putting his hands on and touching God's, you know, at that time, God's representative on the earth, the high priest. So he stood up against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken without hand. Antiochus did not die in battle. He died of a disease. And the Antichrist will die the same way. He will not die. He will die at the Battle of Armageddon, but he will not die because of a sword or a bullet. God himself is going to kill him. He's going to be broken without any man's hand being involved in it. The Lord himself is going to destroy him. All right? All right. Now, I wanted to go to chapter 11 because there's so much more in chapter 11. In chapter 11, we don't have time to really look at this. If you're interested and you want to see it a little bit further, Daniel chapter 11, God is still focusing on Greece. Why? I mean, if Greece's time came and went, and then the Roman Empire would be there, and there would... I mean, what is the significance of spending so much time on that empire if it doesn't come up again in the future? All right, notice in Daniel chapter 11, it says, verse 3, now God is speaking about the kingdom of Greece. You can see the last word of verse 2. And a mighty king shall stand up, Alexander, that shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. And when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken and shall be divided toward the four winds. There it is again. The four parts of Alexander's empire. And not to his posterity, because he didn't have a son to turn it over to. So, and look, Alexander wasn't even born yet when Daniel wrote this. But every word of God is pure. And it'll happen just the way God wrote it. So, it doesn't go to his posterity, nor according to his dominion which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be plucked up even for others beside those. And now from this point on, God zeroes in on two of those parts of Alexander's empire. The king of the south, which is Ptolemy in Egypt, and the king of the north, which was Seleucus in Syria. And notice here, verse 5, the king of the south shall be strong. And it then... We won't look at this, but from verse 5 all the way to verse 12 are actually a description of wars and things that happened concerning Egypt, the king of the south, right? Then verse 13, the king of the north shall return and set forth a multitude. And so from verse 13 all the way down to verse number 35, it's speaking about the human king of the north, Seleucus and his descendants. And the description of these verses, actually, if you took history books, you could match up the battles that are described here between all the things that happened between Egypt and Syria in those years leading up to the time of Jesus Christ. But then in verse 35 and 36, the Lord leaps over 2,000 years of history. He jumps right over the church age, because Daniel doesn't write about the church. He didn't see that. The church was something hidden to the prophets in the Old Testament. So they jump right over 2,000 years of church history. And Daniel jumps from the Antiochus that reigned in Syria, the little horn, to the little horn of the last days, which is the Antichrist. And notice here, in it, the clue is in verse 35, some of them of understanding shall fall to try them, to purge, to make them white, even to the time of the end. The time of the end, that phrase is found in Daniel five times. And it always refers to the time of the tribulation. That is the time of the end. So when you see that expression in verse 35, guess where it leaps to in the next verse? In the next verse, you jump to the time of the end. And notice it says, verse 36, the rest of this is a description of the Antichrist. The king shall do according to his will. He shall exalt himself and magnify himself above every god, shall speak marvelous things against the God of gods, shall prosper till the indignation be accomplished. Verse 37, neither shall he regard the God of his fathers. Now, the Muslim traces his lineage back to Abraham. He will not regard the God of his fathers. Even Ishmael, Abraham's son, who's the father of the Arab nation, knew Abraham's God. Because God spoke to Ishmael's mother. God protected Ishmael. Abraham circumcised his son. I mean, Ishmael grew up as a young man knowing the God of his father, Abraham. But this Antichrist does not honor the God of his fathers, Abraham and Ishmael. All right? He worships a different God. Nor the desire of women. That has nothing to do with he's not attracted to women. I used to think it was. Used to think perhaps the guy, the Antichrist, is going to be a homosexual. It doesn't mean that at all. It means as desire here means as it does the first time it shows up in the scriptures, where God tells Eve that your desire shall be unto your husband. And God tells Abel, or tells Cain, that Abel, his brother's desire shall be unto Cain. Meaning, he'll bring you his wishes, his desires, and you'll have authority over those things. But Islam today could care less about what a woman wants. Islam today has no regard for the wishes or desires of a woman. A woman has no status whatsoever in Islam. She's property, that's all. She's the property of her husband. He can do whatever he wants to with her. Within certain limits, but she's still considered property. That's all. So this God, this Antichrist will not regard the, he'll have no regard for the God of his fathers, Abraham and Ishmael. He'll not regard the Lord. He'll not regard the desire of women, nor regard any God. In his heart, he's really, it's all about his own power. And it says, for he shall magnify himself above all. But in his estate shall he honor the God of forces. In other words, war, armies. That's his real God. Bloodshed. You know, spreading his kingdom by the sword. And a God whom his fathers knew not shall he honor with gold and silver. And so on and so forth. And in verse 40, and at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him. So in the tribulation, Egypt is going to resist, actually, the Antichrist. So his kingdom is not going to be, perhaps, 100% control of every Muslim nation, because some of them actually resist him. And Egypt resists in the time of the tribulation. And it goes on here. You can read the rest of it. It says, even Edom and Moab, verse 41, shall escape out of his hand. So those are the Jordanians or the Palestinians. So there's going to be a lot of controversy and so on and so forth in the Middle East. all right. I wish I had more time to go into some other things in Daniel chapter 11. A couple of quick things, and we're done. Book of Job, 42 chapters, 42 months in the tribulation. Job is a picture of Israel persecuted and tested and tried by the Lord himself. But in Job chapter 1, Job's children, sons and daughters, are all killed by two groups of people, Chaldeans and Sabians. And so I was just curious, if Job is a picture of Israel in the tribulation, 42 chapters, 42 months of the tribulation, and Job is a picture of Israel being hurt and persecuted, who persecuted Job? Who took away all his wealth? Who took away all his children? Sabians. Look on any map of the Middle East in those days, Sabians were Saudi Arabia. It was in the Arabian Peninsula. And the Chaldeans would be Iraq. So here's Job, who took away his sons and daughters, those nations. And then it says, and then a great wind from the wilderness destroyed everything else. And you can just look up wind and wilderness in the scriptures. It's found one other time, and it's a wind that comes out of Saudi Arabia. So Job as a picture is being, look what took away everything he had. But then, praise the Lord, at the end of the book of Job, everything is restored double. So he gets everything back. The other thing, this came to me, and this was just today, I was thinking about this. On the day of Pentecost, I was just curious. The Bible tells you that there are people from all these nations in the world that were in the city of Jerusalem on the day of Pentecost and heard the gospel of the kingdom. Just read down through that list of countries that was there on Pentecost. They were Parthians, Medes, and Elamites. That's Iran. They were from Mesopotamia. That's Iraq. Cappadocia, Pontus, Asia, Phrygia, Pamphylia. That's Turkey. Egypt, Libya, Cyrene, which is in Libya, and Arabia. So, now they're Jews, but notice where they're coming from. So the nations that heard the gospel on day one, because that gospel went back to those countries, even though it's Jewish people, those countries got the gospel first from those Jewish people. And then in the last days, those countries are all the same ones that turn on Israel and attack her. The only other nation that's mentioned there that is not Islamic in Acts chapter 2 is Rome. Pretty interesting. So it looks like Rome will also have a major part. I don't know what part they play, but Rome, maybe the Roman Catholic Church, will have a major part in the events of the last days. Okay, we're just going to have to stop there. And I think there's so much more that I want to say, but we just can't go on indefinitely with this subject, but we'll just end it there, sort of sum that up, and next Wednesday night, Lord willing, we'll go on with a next completely unrelated point to Islam. All right, but thank you for bearing with all of this. I hope it's a help. I hope it provokes you or makes you curious, makes you want to read, makes you want to study a little bit more, because there's certainly something much more to this than ever met the eye before. And we'll keep looking at it, and if things get a little clearer or whatever, we'll bring it out. But anyway, all right, we'll stop right there. Thank you so much. Let's just bow our heads right now. Father, Lord God, we thank you tonight for your word.